Hi, this is Eric Schlein with the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by Songfinch. Songfinch is a personalized gifting company that brings you stories, feelings, and memories to life through one-of-a-kind songs. With the option to have a song created from scratch or to personalize an existing song foundation, their community of professional songwriters will handcraft the most personal gift that you can give. It's the perfect gift for anniversaries, weddings, Mother's Day, Father's Day, birthdays, and any other of life's special occasions. Songs start at only $99, and they're delivered within 7 days. They work with over 300 professional musicians, so your one-of-a-kind song will sound like it belongs on the radio and not just a corny jingle. So once completed, your song lives on a personal web link called your story homepage, where you can listen and download the song, read the lyrics, learn about your songwriter, and share your song on social platforms. Use promo code INVEST at checkout for 10% off your song from scratch and give the best gift that you've ever given.
Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You're listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, episode 15. We have Tobias Carlisle on the show today. A little bit about Tobias. He is a founder and managing partner of Carbon Beach Asset Management and serves as the chief investment officer. He is best known as the author of the websites The Acquirers Multiple and Greenbacked, and has written tons of books, has extensive experience in investment management, business valuation, public company corporate governance, and corporate law. Prior to founding the forerunner at Carbon Beach in 2010, Tobias was an analyst in an activist hedge fund, general counsel of a company listed on the Australian Stock Exchange. He has done a ton of stuff, and I'm glad for you to be on the show. Welcome.
Hey, thanks, Eric. Appreciate the very kind intro there.
Absolutely. Well, it's an honor to have you on the show. You're an amazing author and incredibly smart, so I'm looking forward to this.
Cool, me too.
Yeah, right on. So tell us a little bit about, for the listeners who aren't familiar with you, a little bit about how you got into the world of investments, a little bit about your background, and we can go from there.
Sure. So I'm Australian. I grew up in a little country town in the Australian outback, studied law at college. After I graduated, I went to work in a national law firm in Australia doing mergers and acquisitions, working on, just because of the time, I started in 2000 part-time, 2002 full-time, and it was just sort of, it was very tech-heavy kind of time in the market, so there were lots of IPOs initially, and then lots of mergers and acquisitions, and lots of activist work as well, because the companies raised a lot of cash, didn't really have much of a business plan, and then they had sort of things that are very attractive to activists. They had lots of cash on the balance sheet, and the businesses were basically just burning cash. And so all of these little companies attracted net liquidation-style activists who got control, stopped the business, and paid out the cash to themselves or used this as a cash box to buy other companies. And I just found it sort of a fascinating thing because I had read Warren Buffett's letters by that stage, and so I was very much trying to be a wonderful company at a fair price, compounder-style investor, and it just, these type of transactions just made no sense. Why would they want a business that's, it's a terrible business and it's burning cash? And I realized, of course, they were trying to get control of the cash in the company. So I thought, next time I see one of those, that sort of thing in the market where the market collapses and there are these companies around that have got some cash, I'll make sure to remember that and try and replicate it. And so then I spent the next 5 years, 6 years working as a lawyer in Australia. I transferred to San Francisco, kept on doing tech M&A there. That was sort of at a time when there was really not much going on. The only thing that anybody could do the only kind of acquisitions that were going on were guys who'd come up with little apps using Google's map technology, and they'd get acqui-hired, which is like they give them a little signing bonus. Basically, they buy your technology just so they can get the software engineers into the into Google.
Yeah.
And so we were doing little acquisitions. There were Indian fab. chip makers who were trying to get some more IP. There were guys who were making CDs. So it was a kind of a really eclectic technology mix in San Francisco for a few years. I went back to be general counsel of an internet infrastructure company in Australia that I'd listed when I was working in Australia. And it was dark fiber, had a peering fabric, which is a technical thing that probably if you've never heard of it, don't worry about it.
Okay, I was going to ask, but okay.
well, peering fabric is, so if you have web firms that are sort of content providers, and then you have other firms that are sort of content consumers, internet service providers, basically consumers of content. And if they go out along the telecommunications, the cables that are owned by telcos, you have to pay a price to do that. And so it's cheaper to go onto a fabric where it's like a meet me point where there's a whole lot of, there are content providers and there are content consumers. And so they pay a lower price because they cut out the middleman and they just do it in a data center. So they start, this firm had started out as a peering firm. Then they had built out the dark fiber capability and they built out data centers. And then the most exciting thing that we did was building a subsea cable from Australia to Guam, which is a U.S. territory, and so needed to be vetted by all of the three-letter agencies in the U.S. And so I sort of did all, help with all the sales, help with the construction of it, and help with all of the regulatory stuff flying to Washington to kind of get it done. And at the end of that, the firm was bought by a bigger player, and I had a little bit of money and some time. And so I decided I wanted a career change, which was to become a full-time investor. And I found a firm that was an activist, undervalued asset investor. And I set up shop there, and that was like August 2008. And so I just watched the market collapse like down 25% or even more than that over that period that I was there, after it had already been down quite a lot. And I thought, now is a good time to start doing that old net strategy that liquidation strategy that I saw in the early 2000s. So I started a website called Greenbacked, which just basically dug up any kind of net liquidation style stock that had an activist involved. And I published the little write-ups on Greenbacked, and those just because the market was really crushed, and then it recovered like 6 months after that. They all did really, really well, and I was sort of able to do some other things.
Right on, yeah. And I have to say, too, I've been a fan of Greenbacked for years. So it's an incredible website. And then tell us a little bit about – so you also have a website. So besides Greenbacked, you have another website called The Acquirer's Multiple. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, at the end of – just to go back a little bit, after I set up Greenbacked kind of the stock picks all did really, really well. Like the combined stock picks did something like 250% in the first year. And I thought, I'm really, really good at this. And then I went back and looked at all of the net-nets that I didn't buy. And basically, if I just bought every single net-net and not worried about, you know, all the analysis that I had done, that cohort had done something like 750% for the year.
Oh, wow.
And so I discovered this, the quantitative approach to investment. And I just sort of researched it a little bit, started writing some articles about it on Greenbacked. Wes Gray, who was a PhD student at the time, writing his thesis on quantitative value stuff, because he was at Booth, which is the best sort of quant school in the States, and he said, let's collaborate on a book. I'll sort of do the back testing, and you write up the ideas. And so that first book was Quantitative Value, and that came out in 2012. As we were doing that, we sort of basically quantitative value. We went and found any industry or academic research that discussed like fundamental value investment strategies. So price to book. So looking at valuation, looking at quality, mm-hmm. Looking at financial distress or fraud or ways to detect things like that in a statistical way. And then we built this model and it worked really well.
Had this not been done before in this way?
Well, Jim O'Shaughnessy had written What Works on Wall Street, where he did look at value strategies, but he didn't at that edition of the book, he hadn't combined them like that. I don't know if it was necessarily 100% original, but it was sort of the only one that had been dedicated to value, and so we sort of dug into some things that other people hadn't done. The model that we came up with is not necessarily the best way of doing it. It was just a way that sort of made sense, and it turns out that it tests pretty well. And it's the way that a careful value investor might go about doing their value investment strategy. So the strategy does really well. Wes turned it into QVAL, which is an ETF that works now. In the course of doing it, I kept on thinking back to the deep value style that I had sort of preferred, and I by that stage I'd read The Magic Formula. Mm-hmm. The Little Book That Beats the Market by Joel Greenblatt, which includes the strategy of The Magic Formula. It's a very successful book, very popular book. For those who haven't read it, the idea is basically he took Warren Buffett's investment strategy as he's described it in his letters, and there are two elements to it. One is the wonderful company part, which Buffett defines as a high return on invested capital, sustainable high return on invested capital, and Greenblatt defined as return on invested capital, which is basically operating earnings on invested capital in a single year. And then he had a fair price, which is you're looking for an undervalued stock, and so he used EBIT on enterprise value, operating earnings on enterprise value, and then he combined the two together, ranked every stock on quality, every stock on value, combined the two together, created this strategy that beat the market. So we tested it in quantitative value, and it definitely works. But I was aware of this thing that if you took away the quality metric, then you got even better returns again. That's the return on invested capital, and that makes no sense really, because it seems like that's the sort of thing, that's exactly the sort of thing you want. So I was kind of fascinated by that. I went and tested that specific idea, and it turns out that the operating earnings on enterprise value, which I call the acquirer's multiple, because that's the term that I had heard in the late 1990s, early 2000s. It turns out that beats the combined magic formula pretty consistently, and it doesn't matter what market capitalization group you look in. It doesn't really matter what time you look in, and it doesn't really matter what country you look in. It's true sort of in Europe, the UK, Japan, Australia. It's true in all the sort of developed markets around the world. And so I wrote an entire book, which is Deep Value, which was exploring the idea, why do sort of ugly, scary stocks tend to be things that look a little bit better, even when they're cheap?
Right. Didn't you write about how net nets that were profitable actually underperformed net nets that weren't profitable?
So there are all of these crazy things. When you start digging into it, it's amazing. So even profitable net nets beat unprofitable net – sorry, unprofitable net nets do better than profitable ones. So in the profitable ones, the ones that pay a dividend do worse than the ones that don't pay a dividend.
I remember that, yeah.
And you can if you're aware of this kind of phenomenon and you start looking for it in the literature, it's amazing how often you find it. So the most admired companies in America, there's a study, I think it's by Fortune magazine, every year the most admired companies in America and they're combined compared to the least admired companies in America. And consistently the least admired outperform the most admired over the next 12 months.
Wild.
There's this great book. Tom Peters wrote this book in the early 1980s called In Search of Excellence. And the idea, I think he was a McKinsey consultant, or he could have been Bain, something like that. He went and tracked down all of the excellent companies in the US as he defined them. I don't think there was any sort of formal process to it. They just sort of, what are the companies that everybody wants to be like? And then he went and looked at their financial characteristics, and they all had very high returns on assets, very rapid growth, very profitable, also very expensive, traded at like 2.5 times book. This analyst, Michelle Clayman, found those and tested them and found that the stock price performance of them wasn't that good. And so she came up with this unexcellent idea where she basically reversed all of those metrics and found the ones that were the worst return on equity, worst return on assets, shrinking, and as a result, also very cheap. They were less than two-thirds book. And then she compared the performance of those two. And she found that the unexcellent massively outperformed the excellent. And one of her analysts now works at Stifel as head of research, Barry Bannister, and he did a test over the full data period running 2013 when he published it, 2014 when he published it, through to 1972. Unexcellent absolutely crush excellent over the full period. It's this thing you find over and over and over again in the literature, and it's simply, the reason is simply mean reversion, which is the idea that basically things go back to normal. So things that look really good tend to come back to normal. Things that look really bad tend to go back to normal, and you want to be on the one going up, which means that the bad ones tend to get better.
Right. So to apply this, you know, to someone who's, you know, investing for themselves, how do you, you know, determine when you sell something? Is it when it hits book value, when it hits net current asset value? What's your sell rules essentially?
Well, I created a website, the acquirersmultiple.com, which scans for these companies. So that basically I say on the site there are two approaches that you can use. One is quant investor, where you're sort of relying on the probabilities and you buy a portfolio of them and you hold them. I think that these are rules that are similar to Greenblatt's, and they're good rules. Basically, the bulk of the return from these undervalued stocks occurs in the first year, although they do continue to beat the market out to 5 years. But you can get most of the return in the first year. So you just hold them for about a year, and at the end of 12 months minus one day, you want to sell the losers because that brings the losses into the current tax year.
Right.
12 months plus one day, you sell the winners because then you get long-term capital gains, and hopefully it also shifts the gains into the following tax year. So about a year is fine. You can scale in or out, so you can do it on a monthly or quarterly basis. It depends on how much time you want to spend doing it. If you're a what I call a business owner type approach to that, this is where you actually go in and you value these companies, and you might choose which ones you like and ignore the others. In that scenario, you should be sort of holding on until they reach intrinsic value. And the reason that that's a good approach is that often these stocks have depressed intrinsic values because the return on equity is very low, but it tends to sort of mean revert back to the average. So you get this improvement in the intrinsic value of the company. And at the same time, they're trading at a big discount to that depressed intrinsic value. So as they get healthier, the discount closes as well, which is why the returns tend to be a little bit better than in the ones that scan for the high return on invested capital, which sort of tend to pick companies right at the very top of their business cycle. So there's two approaches. The quant one, it's basically just a timing approach, and the business owner one, it's more looking at the intrinsic value and investing that way.
Interesting. Have you and Joel Greenblatt ever talked? And is he familiar with what you do?
Never. He's an investing legend, and I'm a peon out in Los Angeles. So no, we've never crossed paths. Although I'm almost certain that he's aware. I've heard people have raised the idea to him, and I know that that people have seen some presentations where he shows the distribution of the returns along two axes, one of which is the value axis, and the other one is the return on invested capital axis, and he's consistently the returns tend to cluster towards the value axis.
Interesting. And how many stocks do you typically hold at one time for something like this?
So I've written a third book called Concentrated Investing, which looks at exactly that problem. That's one of those funny times where the academic advice, which is put together on a totally different basis, it's constructed on efficient market hypothesis grounds, that comes out at about 30. And if you look at what value investors from Graham to Seth Klarman to a lot of other guys. That also falls out at about 30. So I think 30 is a pretty good number. More than that, it gets too hard to manage and you don't get much additional benefit from the diversification at that level.
Yeah.
Fewer than that, you get more volatility in your portfolio. So the happy medium is somewhere between 20 and 30. 20 is fine. It's just that from moving from 20 stocks to 30 stocks gives you a little bit more additional risk-adjusted return. But on a raw basis, there's more return at 20. It's just that, you know, you can have lots of volatility in these portfolios. So if something, if one of the stocks goes to zero in a 20-stock portfolio, you lose 5% of your portfolio.
Right.
In a 30-stock portfolio, you lose a little bit over 3%. Basically, you're approaching these on a portfolio basis, though, so you're not worried about really what happens to individual stocks. You'll find it as you do this, about half are up and about half are down in any given year, and the half that are up are just up a little bit more, and it's that sort of, or there's a few more that are up, and it's that what that is what drives the entire performance of the portfolio.
Yeah. Now, are you, do you recommend this kind of diversification when you're dealing with, say, these low-quality companies? Because, right, there's the other view that when you're dealing with higher-quality companies that you can be a lot more concentrated. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, that's the way the concentrated Buffett-style investors, the compound guys, so they're looking for good companies that are growing and are getting marginally better, but they're, you know, they're fairly priced. They're not underpriced.
Right.
And so for them to generate returns in the sort of level that Buffett was doing at like 15 to 20%, you have to be more concentrated into those ideas. If you're in companies like this that tend to be quite volatile and they tend to be lower, not always. I'm always astonished at the quality companies that fall into this basket. You know, Apple last year was in this basket, Gilead. There's always some really high quality companies that fall into it. And but they do, it does tend to be dominated by commodity type companies or airlines or things like that. So, you know, it bought Apple before Buffett bought Apple. It bought airlines before Buffett bought airlines. So I sometimes say I think Buffett is really a closet deep value guy, and he just waits for these very high quality companies to fall into the absolute cheap basket, and then he sort of he pulls the trigger on them.
Interesting. And now you have a new book out, right?
Right. So one of the I published my first three books through Wiley, and that's a great experience to do that. But they've tended to be they're $85 books, sort of
yeah.
quasi academic, written at a high sort of reading level and sort of aiming for like an MBA type market.
Just for the listeners, we were joking before that the most expensive Kindle book I ever bought was one of yours. It was like $40 or something for a Kindle book,
which is crazy.
That's
right?
Insane. Yeah.
But the new book. So I wanted to get away with that. So I've self-published this book. It's called The Acquirer's Multiple: How the Billionaire Contrarians of Deep Value Beat the Market. Basically, it takes all of the ideas from my first three books and from other interesting things I've learned since I last published in 2016 last year, and it puts them into a book that you can read in about 2 hours. So it's 160 pages. It's purposefully written to be readable to a grade 8 level. And it's got lots and lots of pictures and sort of my drawing of the ideas in it, plus a whole lot of back testing of the ideas. And so I've written it really simply. I've given it to a whole lot of people who aren't stock market people and asked them to read it. So the idea is that if there's any term in there that's not sort of immediately obvious to a person who's not necessarily a full-time investor, it's described in there in pretty simple terms. So it's only literally just been published over the last week.
Congratulations.
And thank you. And it's up in paperback for $15.99 or Kindle for $9.99.
Would you say this is your favorite book that you've written, or?
you know, it's a little bit like children. Your most recent child is your most favorite child. I'm just kidding. So this, I had a lot of fun writing this one. Cause I think, you know, there's always the urge to, when I wrote my first book, I wanted to sort of show off maybe a little bit. And so it's probably the hardest book to read. But as I've gone along, I've realized that what you really want to do is make books that are very readable. So the idea is that this one is supposed to be very readable. And it was more fun to produce it as a result because I sort of had to go back to first principles. And it's amazing the stuff that I probably just hadn't fully understood the first time through. And I feel like I do now.
Explain to the listeners what you mean by first principles.
So, I know what EBITDA is, but I know what EBIT is, I know what operating earnings are, but I have to kind of define them. And so it's difficult to, I've been using those terms for 15 years. So I had to go back and think, what's the real difference between these things? Why is it that enterprise value is a better strategy than market cap? And so just going through and defining those terms was sort of just a good refresher course for me. And I think that it's worth reading this. Even if you've got some expertise and you've been doing it for a long time, because it does define these terms and put them into context. Because I think we forget sometimes the reasons why we do things.
Yeah, well, that's like with anything, right? When you're in it for so long.
100%.
Fascinating. What would you say are the, from your new book, like the biggest takeaways or the, you know, like I know in your other book you were saying, well, you know, the fact that these low quality companies outperform the higher quality companies, and that's like a huge, almost counterintuitive insight. Were there any like huge insights from this book that you could, you know, share with the readers as a little teaser?
The only caveat to that is that the very worst return on invested capital do tend to be stocks that you want to avoid. Companies that are created just to lose money, you know, like it's a mine or it's a hole in the ground. Are they going to turn into a mine? Mm-hmm. Or it's a biotechnology company that's sort of got no revenues. It's purely set up to burn money. They don't tend to do very well.
So does your screen avoid those, the acquirer's multiple screen?
What it does is it looks for positive operating earnings. So it requires that they have... So when I say that these are junky companies, that what I mean is that they're not companies that burn cash. They actually do have a history of making money. They're not science experiments, and they're not sort of toys. Like they have a real business, and they've got a pretty good balance sheet because they have to, in order to get through the screen, they have to have either lots of cash and no debt, or more cash than debt, or they have to have very strong operating earnings in relation to that sort of the part of the company that you're paying for. And when you test that, it's amazing that it works so well. I asked this, there's a Seattle-based firm called Euclidean Technologies, and they do some machine learning, and they have, I think, one of the best backtesting databases in the States. And so I asked them to help me with the backtesting for the book. So I gave them basically Greenblatt's backtest rules that he publishes in the little book that beats the market. And then I asked them to test the acquirer's multiple, so just eliminating the return on invested capital. So they've done all the testing and produced the charts and things that you see in the book. And I'm always amazed that it's so much stronger in, it works in small cap stocks. It works in very large cap stocks. There is this interesting phenomenon this time around, though, that I hadn't seen before, that the magic formula and the acquirer's multiple were much closer together in terms of performance in the largest half of all stocks. And I think the reason for that is when the market gets a little bit like this, when the market gets frothy, mm-hmm. and expensive, and it tends to be sort of momentum stocks that do better, it's the magic formula does tend to do a little bit better in this type of market because it's already looking for very highly profitable companies. So I think the magic formula issuer in one of the tests has caught up to the acquirer's multiple a little bit. But and that was a good reminder, because that is something that happened in the late 1990s as well, when the dot-com boom was going on. You wanted to be in these type of stocks rather than just acquirer's multiple style stocks. And that's, you know, that was when a lot of value guys closed up shop in the late 1990s, and even Buffett, you know, there were Business Week articles, has Buffett lost his touch? That was a very common thing to see. And then in the early 2000s, value had this renaissance where it sort of, value was going up while the rest of the market was falling down. And so there are, you know, lots of guys who are about late 40s now who started out in the early 2000s, who a lot of their record was created at a time when it was very, very favorable for value. So I sort of think that it's been a very tough time for value over the last 7 years, since about April 2010. And I think that there's going to be, if we have a little decline in the market, or if we have a big decline in the market, then I think it's going to be a very good period for value coming up sometime soon.
Well, it'll be interesting to listen to this in 5 years from now and see how that all worked out, eh?
You know, it's amazing that but I would have been saying the same thing, like even maybe not 5 years ago, but 3 or 4 years ago. It's amazing because by then the drawdown had sort of been, or the underperformance of value relative to the market was 3 or 4 years old.
Yeah.
I'm sort of amazed that
it's lasted this long.
I'm amazed that the market has been so persistently strong, you know, relative to value. And it has good years and years where value kind of closes the gap a little bit. Value closed the gap last year, but value's had another tough year this year, even though the last month I think has been quite favorable for value. So it's funny that value is sort of this totally idiosyncratic return stream, different from the market's return stream, but it's got a little bit of catching up to do. So there's some good times for value coming up.
I hope so. Yeah, it's interesting too. This is completely not scientific in me saying this, but I've always thought, you know, it's like we're always amazed when we see something that, you know, we're not used to. The fact that the market has done as well as done, the fact that value has underperformed for as long as it has, right? And it's not normal or typical. But we only, you know, in terms of stock market data, right, we only have, I don't know, a few hundred years of stock market data, maybe less than that, right? So
I think you can get back to 1880, okay. But that's just sort of price data.
All right. So again, not scientific in me saying this, but I always wonder, it's like if we had 1,000 years of data, you know, 1,000 years into the future of market history, would we look back at this and say, oh, this is actually kind of normal? You know, we haven't, you know, seen it before. So it's something that I've thought about.
It's almost a metaphysical question.
Right.
The thing is, if you had 1,000 years of data, you'd need 2,000 or 10,000. You can never get certainty
right. With
this stuff. I think the best way to approach it is to think about it on a common sense basis. I mean, this is how we've done some of our testing. We think about on a common sense basis, what are we trying to achieve? And then we try to find a way to express that rather than going and running a whole lot of tests that make no sense at all, and then trying to kind of fit a narrative to those tests.
I appreciate that. Very easy to do for a lot of people. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I appreciate the deep value. Like for some people, I think deep value is very, very intuitive. I mean, I fall into that camp. I think that deep value is very, very intuitive. Intuitive because I think that, you know, what value investors have traditionally tried to do is find kind of older, boring companies or companies that are going through a bit of a crisis and to buy those companies and then enjoy the improvement in the underlying business. And along with that, you get the closure of the market price discount. But I think that it's a more recent thing where, you know, Buffett has been so successful and he's said, you look for these branded or multi-style companies, and they can protect their high return on invested capital. And so you can have the best of both worlds. You can have this very high rate of growth and a fair valuation or a high-ish valuation. You know, if you do DCFs on some of the very good companies, you get very high implied multiples for their valuation. You could see a 40 times PE being fair value if the company's growing rapidly and has a very high return on invested capital. Yeah. To me, I would, no matter how quality, high quality I thought the company was, assuming that that it's not a depressed earnings, I would find that very uncomfortable to invest at that sort of level.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that value investing works generally because it's not intuitive to a lot of people, right? If it was intuitive for everyone and everyone did this, probably wouldn't work anymore.
100%, that's true.
Yeah.
But if the stock market didn't exist and you had to go and buy these businesses privately, how else would you come up with a valuation for them? Even if it's not necessarily a two people could look at the same business and say I'll pay three times the operating earnings of this business, and the other person would say I'd pay 10 times the operating value of this business. So the range can be very, very wide. But if you think about, because as a lawyer too, I did a lot of private equity transactions, and I remember some of the older guys. When I say older guys, they must have been in their 50s or 60s mm-hmm. when I was just starting out, and they had sort of come through the 1980s, which had been an LBO boom, and they said when we first started out, if you were paying three times EBITDA, you're paying three times operating earnings. That was considered to be very fully valued. That was where the transactions were done. And as we went through that process, it got up to like eight or nine times near the end of the 1980s kind of LBO boom. And they thought that was a crazy level to be doing these deals at. And if you look at the multiples now, I think that the average multiple is something like 12 times where these deals are getting done. So there's been this extreme expansion, like that's four times on a multiple basis over sort of 30 years.
That's wild, huh?
It's sort of it's one of those things that I don't know if it's cyclical and I don't know if it's secular.
Yeah.
My instinct is that it's cyclical, but it looks secular where we are in the cycle, looking back, probably since when it started in the early 1980s.
Interesting. It's fascinating what you do.
That's very kind.
Is there anything else that you would you'd like to share to the listeners, or anything else you'd like to talk about?
No, just that if they're looking for me, I can be found on Twitter at greenbacked.com. It's a funny spelling, but do you have show notes? Well, we can put it up in your show notes.
I'll put it up
in
the show notes.
The new book is called The Acquirer's Multiple: How the Billionaire Contrarians of Deep Value Beat the Market. It's available in Amazon as a paperback or on Kindle. And if you go to the website acquirersmultiple.com, there's a free screen for the largest 1,000 stocks. It just shows the cheapest 30 according to our methodology in the largest 1,000. And so and Johnny Hopkins, who runs the site, is always putting up new articles and chatting on the site.
All right, great. And I'll make sure to put all that in the show notes.
Cool.
All right. Well, thanks again for your time. It was great having you on. And
thanks, Eric. It was a fun chat.
Definitely. All right. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.